Hello everyone, this is Steve Phelan for People, Places, and Things, readings from the archives of American Heritage Magazine. Last week, we began reading the article, Let Us Die to Make Men Free. Tears ran down the cheeks of Abraham Lincoln when he heard the Battle Hymn of the Republic sung in Congress by a chaplain who had survived a Confederate prison. It would become the most famous literary production of the Civil War. And we'll continue here. The highlight of the evening for Lincoln, and certainly for others in the House chamber, was a rendition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Chaplain Charles C. McCabe, a frequent speaker and fundraiser for the commission. In 1862, while chaplain of the 122nd Ohio Infantry, McCabe had been captured by Confederate forces and taken to Libby Prison in Richmond. He was there on July 6, 1863, when news reached the inmates of the Union victory at Gettysburg. The soldiers burst into song, everything from Yankee Doodle to religious hymns. But then McCabe led them in singing the words of a poem he had clipped from the Atlantic Monthly and memorized. He knew Julia Ward Howe's poem matched the cadences of John Brown's Body, a favorite Union marching song, and the prisoners joined him in the chorus, singing Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. McCabe told this moving story of his prison experience and then sang the battle hymn as a duet with an Army colonel just released from Libby, asking the audience to join him in the chorus, accompanied by a regimental brass band. According to the Sunday School Times, McCabe sang, quote, with much sweetness and power. Swept up by the refrain, the audience's, quote, enthusiasm was aroused to such a pitch so that few scenes like it have ever been witnessed in a public gathering. Applause greeted the ending of nearly every stanza, the account continued, and in the last, before reaching the chorus, the pent-up enthusiasm could be restrained no longer, but burst forth in a torrent of exultant shouts and cheers that made the hall ring to the roof. Soon, President Lincoln shouted, "Sing it again!" and Vice President Hamlin announced that McCabe would repeat his performance. Before he did so, McCabe delivered a charge to the president from a fellow Libby prisoner, quote, in the name of the martyrs of liberty. Tell the president not to back down an inch. Lincoln replied, I won't back down. And shouts of amen came from the crowd. The uproar and the whole evening were unlike any spectacle most had ever witnessed. For the 27-year-old McCabe, this had been a thrilling commemoration at the Capitol. He was seated right in front of the Lincolns. He wrote to his wife before going to bed that night that during the speeches of two pastors he had, quote, seen tears roll down the rugged cheeks of the president. The press agreed that, quote, there were very few dry eyes in the hall, as pastors told gruesome and sentimental stories of caring for the wounded after Antietam and Gettysburg. According to McCabe's diary, when the president saw him again at a White House reception 2 weeks later, quote, Mr. Lincoln recognized me as the man who sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic at the Capitol and was kind enough to compliment both the song and the singing. My vanity was considerably delighted. Sure, and how could I help it? From this point on, McCabe helped make the Battle Hymn of the Republic inseparable from the Union cause. At fundraising events across the country for the duration of the war and for years afterwards, the Methodist chaplain and later bishop would center Howe's poem in a decidedly evangelical setting, closer to the childhood she left behind than to the world of liberal religion she promoted as an adult. He sang the anthem and told the story of Libby Prison for decades. By the time Julia Ward Howe wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the abolitionist and mother of six was already a respected author and poet, whose writing had appeared in Atlantic Monthly and other journals. The daughter of a wealthy New York banker, she had grown up in a world of privilege, of books, art, and music, good manners, and witty banter, all tempered by evangelical piety. Julia's marriage in 1843 to physician and abolitionist Samuel Gridley Howe plunged her into the intellectual, religious, and reform world of Boston. Her husband counted the leading intellectuals and authors of the city among his friends, and as the furor over slavery grew, he had joined in the Secret Six conspiracy to arm and fund John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Howe was forced to flee to Canada for a time to avoid arrest. After the war began, Julia's contributions to the Atlantic and Horace Greeley's New York Tribune became more prominent. In November 1861, 7 months after the attack on Fort Sumter, she and a group of prominent Bostonians, including Massachusetts Governor John Andrew, traveled to Washington to look into the progress in the war and the work of the Sanitary Commission. Julia hoped to see the encampments and battlefields that she had only imagined from a distance in Boston, and wanted to somehow contribute to the cause of emancipation as well as restoration of the Union. The group stayed in the Willard Hotel near the White House, attended church services, and visited Congress and the White House, meeting with President Lincoln. When she heard soldiers singing John Brown's Body, Julia later recalled, she, quote, remarked to a friend that she had always wished to write some verses which might be sung to that tune. On November 18, the group obtained military passes to travel to Northern Virginia to witness a review of General Irwin McDowell's division of 10,000 troops, including soldiers from Massachusetts. The review was interrupted when messengers alerted McDowell about a nearby skirmish involving some of his pickets and Confederate cavalry, and he immediately dispatched troops to repel the attack. Quote, "The excitement to us was great, for we did not know, nor probably did the generals, but that it might be the beginning of a great battle," wrote Reverend James Clark, a minister in the group, later. "We left our carriage and climbed on the ramparts of a fort nearby, where we could see better. The firing continued in the distance for perhaps 3/4 of an hour." Julia did not want to leave the scene, and sang songs, quote, appropriate to the hour, Clark later wrote. Eventually they headed back to Washington. Quote, "Long streams of red flames ran over the hills, and followed the courses of dried-up streams, choked with sticks and leaves. So at last, passing the great heavy gates of Fort Albany and Fort Runyon, we reached the long bridge and returned into Washington, bearers of the news of another skirmish." Having heard the John Brown song, seen the encampments in the twilight and the campfires dotting the scene, and having heard bugle calls piercing the air, Julia returned to the Willard and went to bed. By her own account, she woke before dawn the next morning. She often experienced half-waking, half-sleeping dreams or visions, at times in great detail. Troubled and depressed by the state of the Union effort, she looked out over the moonlit streets of Washington from her hotel room. Later, a friend recalled that, quote, "She told us that her mind was so burdened with sorrow for her country that she knew not whether she slept or not, but finally a vision seemed to envelop all of her faculties. Slowly the vision, call it inspiration or revelation as you will, was outside and beyond herself. It took form in prophetic words and lines of verse till she could no longer remain quiet." In the dark, Julia groped around for a scrap of paper. She was in the habit of using any bit of paper, including the backs of envelopes and the reverse sides of letters, to jot down notes for the lectures and essays or fragments of poetry as they came to her. To write out the poem that morning, she used a piece of Sanitary Commission stationery. The surviving manuscript includes 6 stanzas with only 4 words crossed out and replaced. Given what Julia had seen and heard from the moment her train approached Washington 5 days earlier, the encampments in Maryland and Virginia, the soldiers marching and singing, the apocalyptic preaching, she had a wealth of images at her disposal, images of, quote, the watchfires of 100 circling camps, the, quote, dim and flaring lamps, the, quote, fiery rows of steel and God's fearful yet glorious wrath, a world of sacred flags and sacred rivers, of holy cities and holy wars, of martyr heroes and atoning blood. Through her imagination, war, nation, and faith fused into the perfect poetic expression of the North's religious nationalism, an anthem worthy of the nation in its hour of peril. Monday's skirmish with the Confederates did not deter Julia from returning to the encampments. Wednesday promised to bring the highlight of the week, General McClellan and the Army of the Potomac staging a spectacular grand review for President Lincoln. As the new head of the Union Army, McClellan had every reason to ensure his men put on a good show for the politicians and their guests. Julia and her party joined the throng determined to witness the grand review. As many as 20,000 spectators, including President Lincoln and his cabinet, converged on the fields between Bailey's Crossroads and Munson Hill. Military passes were not required that day. The roads became so congested that simply reaching the parade ground from the city took half the day. When Julia and her friends finally arrived, they saw thousands of infantrymen, joined by cavalry regiments, military bands, artillery salutes, and McClellan and his staff on horseback, reveling in it all with Lincoln and his cabinet. It was the largest military review ever staged in North America. It took 3.5 hours for the regiments to pass, which the Washington Evening Star estimated totaled 75,000 men. This, at last, appeared to be a fighting force ready for action, irresistible in its magnitude and skill, the hope of the besieged city and fractured nation. The next day, Julia boarded the train back to Boston, and later claimed that on that trip she read the yet unnamed poem to her minister. The Atlantic Monthly published the poem the following February, 1862, and soldiers were still soon singing it throughout the army and ministers reading it from the pulpits. The song became an embodiment of the religious nationalism that swept the country during the long, brutal war. For years afterward, Julia helped to popularize her battle hymn in lecture halls, pulpits, and leading periodicals for children and adults. Especially after Samuel's death in 1876, she needed to stay busy to support herself and toured the nation for decades. The battle hymn became Howe's tagline on the Lyceum circuit. Her speaker's bureau advertised Howe as, quote, the author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic and many other well-known poems. His client was available for serious lectures on social issues and discourses on philosophy, as well as, quote, comic entertainments. She would even fill the pulpit for Sunday services when desired. There was strong demand among the 500 lyceums across the country. And the, quote, battle hymn helped shape religious nationalism in Europe and the North and South America in the 19th century. Quote, altar, saint, apostle, martyr, temple, ark, creed, all of those words were used to speak of the nation-state in wars for independence and wars for national consolidation in places such as Greece, Poland, and the Crimea. During World War I, it was widely sung to emphasize an Anglo-American unity of purpose and was nearly named the American National Anthem. The durability and success of the Battle Hymn of the Republic makes the most sense in the context of romantic nationalism and the philosophical idealism that accompanied it. Julia Ward Howe brought these two worlds together as effectively as anyone of her generation. The way the poem was formulated, how it was put to work, how it was in turn appropriated for wars and reform crusades of all kinds, is best described as religious nationalism. At the very least, religious nationalism more accurately names one aspect of the experience of religion in American life. Americans take pride in their institutional separation of church and state, no matter how much they might disagree about a wall of separation, or whether church is more a danger to the state or the state to the church. Innumerable books attempt to understand church and state in America. If instead of church and state, officials separated for the sake of religious and civil liberty, we think the relationship between religion and nation, a wider world of inquiry opens up before us. If Americans have honored and even strengthened the legal separation of church and state, they have rarely separated religion from nation. Americans, on the whole, have proven eager, on the one hand, to bring nationalism into their churches. Witness the presence of flags at the front, the national anthem sung in worship, political sermons, and even the Pledge of Allegiance in the weekly order of service, and, on the other hand, to bring religion into their celebrations of the sacred nation called upon to do God's will in the world. Woo! All right. We are going to move on to a very timely topic here. And I think I'll start with this because it's really the most cogent. The American Heritage Magazine has just published this month a special issue talking about guns in America. And it's doesn't have a point of view. I think it's just trying to give people some context. So to that extent, I think it's pretty important stuff, and I hope you agree. We'll begin with this article. What does the Second Amendment really mean? To know what the framers intended, we need to understand the historical context. This is by Joseph J. Ellis from, as I said, this month. Editor's note. We asked Professor Joseph Ellis, one of the leading scholars on the founding era, to provide us with the historical context for the Second Amendment and what the founders intended when they wrote it. Professor Ellis won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for History for writing Founding Brothers, the Revolutionary Generation, and he won the National Book Award for American Sphinx, the Character of Thomas Jefferson, both of which were New York Times bestsellers. Portions of this essay appeared in his most recent book, American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. With the recent tragic shootings, the time has come to re-examine carefully the Second Amendment and its interpretation. In 2008, the Supreme Court overturned two centuries of legal precedents to find, in District of Columbia v. Heller, that the Second Amendment sanctioned the right to own and carry a gun except in the rarest of circumstances. The majority opinion was written by Justice Antonin Scalia, the most outspoken originalist on the court, who described Heller in his magnum opus, quote, "the most complete originalist opinion I have ever written." How does Scalia's opinion stand up as an accurate rendering of James Madison's intentions in 1789 when he drafted the Second Amendment? What did the term "bear arms" mean to the revolutionary generation? What was the historical context in the Congress that endorsed the Second Amendment and the states that ratified it? Fortunately, there is an impressive body of evidence in the historical record to permit a faithful rendering of what the Second Amendment originally meant, both to its authors and its audience. In the often bitter debates over ratification in 1788, many anti-federalists had agreed to vote for the new Constitution only if Congress would agree that guarantees of certain personal freedoms and additional limitations on the federal government's power would be included in a set of amendments, what later became known as the Bill of Rights. One section in the Constitution that caused these critics particular concern was the language in Article 1, Section 8, which gave Congress the power to, quote, "provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." the critics saw an ominous projection of federal jurisdiction over the militia-based military establishments of the individual states. First, they were worried about giving Congress the authority, quote, to raise and support armies, parentheses, despite the caveat that no appropriations money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years, and second, granting Congress the power to, quote, provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union and suppress insurrections and repel invasions. This caused so much concern that 5 states recommended an amendment calling for the prohibition of a national standing army on the grounds that such military forces had historically proven to be an enduring threat to Republican values. In the Virginia Convention to ratify the Constitution, Madison was forced to listen as Patrick Henry conjured up apocalyptic scenarios in which the Virginia militia were ordered out from the state to support military operations in faraway places that citizens of the Old Dominion considered misguided deployments in foreign countries. One of the recommended amendments Virginia submitted for consideration in 1788 reflected Henry's concern on this score, drawing on language that had been contained in the Declaration of Rights in its own state constitution, passed on June 26, 1776. That said, quote, the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper national, natural, and safe defense of a free state, that standing armies in times of peace are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided. Madison clearly had Virginia's recommended amendment on his desk and in his mind when he drafted the following words for an amendment. Quote, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country. For unspecified reasons, the Senate reversed the first 2 clauses in Madison's draft, which grammatically clarified the rationale for the right to bear arms, and thus the Second Amendment reads, quote, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. By nodding toward a primary role for the militia, Madison had appeased some of his anti-federalist critics, but he had not satisfied those like Henry, who wanted an unambiguous statement that the state legislatures, and not Congress, enjoyed sovereign control over their own citizenry in times of war. Creating ambiguity, in fact, was the centerpiece of Madison's political agenda. During the debates over ratification that ensued in the House and Senate, as well as those state legislatures that kept a record, considerable attention focused on a current proposal from Secretary of War Henry Knox, calling for a professional army of unspecified size, which opponents described as a violation of the Second Amendment. In 1792, soon after the first 10 amendments were ratified, Congress passed the Militia Act. It required every able-bodied white male citizen between the age of 18 and 45 to enroll in a state militia. It also required them to purchase a gun, as well as a complete outfit of equipment essential to perform their military duties, thereby making gun ownership not an individual right, but a legal obligation. For those disposed to unpack the Second Amendment for the original meaning of bear arms, it has collective implications that lead not only toward the right to own a gun, but toward mandatory national service. In that sense, both Madison and the critics sought to appease were living in a world forever lost to us. There is a fundamental difference between advocates of a, quote, living constitution and originalists. The former could plausibly find reasons to expand a woman's right to choose, make health care a right of citizenship, and reject all state laws prohibiting gay marriage. ardent originalists could plausibly find both Roe v. Wade and Brown v. Board of Education unconstitutional, as well as all New Deal legislation that empowered the federal government to regulate the economy in redistributive ways to include Social Security. It had become received wisdom that the single most consequential power of the presidency was now the power to nominate judges to the Supreme Court. The political direction of the conservative court became clear in a couple of controversial decisions. In Bush v. Gore, 2001, the new conservative majority read the tea leaves of a baffling Florida statute in such a way as to award the presidency to George W. Bush, the only time in American history that the Supreme Court had exercised that power. And then, in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission in 2010, this time overturning a century of precedents, the court found that all federal restrictions on corporate giving to political campaigns were unconstitutional violations of the First Amendment right to free speech. Taken together, or perhaps taken one after the other, the liberal and conservative waves of lawmaking gave the Supreme Court a conspicuous place of prominence in our political culture. It came at a price. For most of American history, the court had enjoyed special status as one branch of government that levitated above the hurly-burly of partisan politics in some transcendent realm reserved for demigods. The Supreme Court, in effect, enjoyed the same kind of privileged treatment that was accorded to the founding generation. In both cases, a kind of electromagnetic field surrounded both the judges on our highest court and the political elite that was, quote, present at the creation. One of the most seductive appeals of the originalist persuasion was the claim to derive its judicial insights from founders who allegedly enjoyed privileged access to eternal truths. After all, why ascribe such enduring significance to the original works or intentions of the framers if you did not regard them, or the historical moment in which they lived, as semi-sacred? Both deifications were always illusions, though extremely useful ones. For the same bundle of reasons that most mortals need to believe in eternity, most new nations require mythical heroes. Similarly, it is comforting to believe all controversial and divisive political questions can be sent to a trusted tribunal composed of godlike judges who possess a preternatural affinity for the truth. Whatever useful purposes such illusions may once have served, over the past half century the scholarship on the founders and the blatantly political character of the Supreme Court makes them untenable. The American founding, most especially the drafting and ratification of the Constitution, was always a messy moment populated by mere mortals, whose chief task was to fashion a series of artful political compromises. And the Supreme Court had never floated above the American political landscape like a disembodied cloud of heavenly wisdom. It always was a political institution comprised of human beings with no special connection to the divine. Both illusions were now exposed as childish fables. In the ongoing debate between advocates of a, quote, living constitution and the originalists, several mitigating factors prevent the most extreme version of each doctrinal position from coming into play. The vast majority of Supreme Court decisions do not involve significant constitutional issues with vast historical consequences. And in many of those cases, the votes are often unanimous opinions that defy doctrinal adjudication. There is also an unspoken understanding among judges on both sides of the political divide that the court should only rarely impose its verdicts in opposition to widespread public opinion. Though both Brown and Citizens United are exceptions to this rule. For example, liberals were predisposed to wait for a sufficient number of lower court decisions on gay rights before ruling on that controversial question, and conservatives recognized that it would be politically dangerous to deploy their originalist arguments against Brown or a case questioning the constitutionality of Social Security. That said, there is a fundamental difference between the two sides of this judicial debate. The liberal devotees of a, quote, living constitution are transparent about their political agenda, but the conservative originalists are not. While the judicial doctrine of the originalists was specifically designed as a weapon to overturn liberal precedents, its core claim is its assiduous political detachment. Or, at least on the face of it, that claim is incompatible with the series of one-sided decisions made by the conservative majority in the 21st century. This was the reason why the usually understated Justice William Brennan described originalism as, quote, arrogance discloaked as humility. All right, we're going to pick up from there next week. In the meantime, for People, Places, and Things, this is Steve Phelan saying, talk to you in a week, everybody.